Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with novelist Roy Hoffman, whose new book is Come Landfall. We'll also hear from poet John Gary, whose new collection is Have At You Now. Alabama writer Roy Hoffman lives in Fairhope, Alabama, the town where it's been said there are more writers than readers. Boasting among its population, W.E.B. Griffin, Fannie Flagg, Sonny Brewer, Winston Groom, and many others. Roy came to writing through journalism and eventually made the turn toward fiction. He's the author of the novels Almost Family, Chicken Dreaming Corn, one of the best titles ever, and two works of nonfiction, Back Home, Journeys Through Mobile, and Alabama Afternoons, Profiles and Conversations. Today we're talking about a new novel, Come Landfall. Roy Hoffman, I am so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
It is my absolute pleasure to be here, Susan.
I feel like we've known each other forever,
That's right.
This is the first time we've met.
Right.
Now, Come Landfall, you really do have this genius for wonderful titles, has its origin in a real family event of yours. So talk about that a bit, would you?
When I was a little boy growing up in Mobile, I heard many stories about my late uncle, Roy Robinson, who had been a Marine in World War II, my mother's brother, and for whom I'm named, who was a prisoner of war in the Philippines and never came home. Because I was named for him, I was the only boy with three older sisters, although my nearest older sister, Robbie, was also named for him because Roy Robinson's nickname was Robbie. There was a special feeling of connection to him and also a great ache that my mother always had, not only because she had lost her beloved brother, but because, as I came to realize as I got older, there was never any sense of closure about what really happened to him.
That terrible mystery.
As time went on and I became a writer and I talked to my dad, who had taken a special interest, my dad was an attorney, in doing the paperwork and trying to find information about Roy in those days, well pre-internet, when it took months or even years to get a correspondence with the War Department and so on. We began to piece together some of the details of his difficult and very sad final days. Roy had been, from the prisoner of war camp in the Philippines, moved to what was then ultimately called a Japanese hell ship, one of these unmarked freighters, where American servicemen were being transported to Japan to be used as slave labor. And many of them did not make it. They were strafed by friendly fire. These were unmarked. It had no Red Cross or POW ship on it. There was no sense that this was a neutral site at all. And Roy did not survive. We never really got the specifics of it. We heard some stories from some other veterans, from a couple of survivors, but mostly his story became one of family lore. So I began to research some of the backgrounds of the hell ships, and having a background in journalism as well as fiction and an interest in both that's been lifelong, I had written a piece for my hometown paper in Mobile about my uncle and another man from Mobile who had also been on another hell ship, each having been lost within his own kind of mysterious fate. And yet, because I did not know a lot about him and because the weight of his loss was really felt most through my mother and the young bride that my uncle had left behind, who I never really knew, he evolved into a fictional character for me. Because for me, fiction is a way to go places that research won't take you, to go behind the closed door, to go into the hold of the ship, and also in this case, really into the hearts of some of the women and family members who kept his memory, but also had that forever sad and lingering puzzlement over what happened to him.
Oh, and I'm telling you, I think the women are really great characters.
Well, I appreciate
in this
that.
Novel. I really do. And one of the things that did for you, I think, turning it into fiction is that it opens the door for this graceful exploration of the legacy of war in a family and from every side, every possible side,
yes.
Because you have the missing soldier, you have the Vietnamese fisherman that I loved yes. his character
Thank
so much.
You.
And then a vet with PTSD, the proud vets that, you know, meet together. And you even have a scene taking place at the National World War II Museum.
That's right, when it was called the D-Day Museum.
Right, back in the day.
Good journalist, I had to make sure that I had the time right. Because a novel principally takes place from 2002 up through 2005. What I felt about the D-Day Museum was that it sort of throws into relief the experiences of service men and women of every age and every war who measure themselves against this epic experience that this museum encompasses and tells the story of, and also sort of wonder what their own place might be in history. Because for many people, and I have a character, a young airman who's a weather specialist, Frank, in this novel, who becomes one of the pivotal characters, everybody is not on the front lines. Everybody doesn't parachute right. onto the beaches, you know, on D-Day. There are radio technicians and engineers and transport people and weather officers, and they play a big role in, and their fate is often bound up in what's happening in Iraq or Afghanistan. So I just wanted to do kind of an ordinary soldier, in this case, young airman, and his ordinary wife and relatives, and see what that impact is, because after all, those are the people who really carry these wars, and what happens mm-hmm. to them, as with my uncle, never goes away.
Well, another thing that I think people will relate to when they read this book is that it's so much about the change that's come to the Gulf Coast. That's another thing that's really going to win readers over, I think. The casinos, the economic dependence on gaming, the military presence, the Vietnamese immigrants, the tension resulting from that. It's just kind of a rich portrait
that.
Of that.
I appreciate that. The South has been written about a great deal. I tried to come at it from the standpoint of someone who was interested in what the contemporary landscape is. My last novel, Chicken Dreaming Corn, was set in the early 1900s, inspired by my grandparents, Eastern European Jews who ended up in Alabama. And before that, Almost Family, a domestic drama with the backdrop of the civil rights movement in the 60s and 70s. I wrote both of those to some extent living away from the South because I lived in New York City for many years. Mm-hmm. And this is a novel that I wrote after coming back South, immersing myself in today's Deep South and Gulf Coast, doing a lot of journalistic work. And the story of Mama on the Porch and the Hound Dog and the whiskey and the guitar, that's still part of what we're about. Literarily, yeah. But there's also the stories of the casinos and the Vietnamese shrimpers and the antebellum homes with the pawn shops
right.
in the next block and the Air Force Base and the Highway 90. You know, that's the South that I wanted to get at, these juxtapositions mm-hmm. that are so fascinating to me and help to provide that little spark for me as a writer, that grit inside of the oyster that makes the pearl.
Right. And this is a novel about religion in so many ways. And it's religiously very diverse. The characters really have all different kinds of beliefs. And you covered religion for many years.
I covered religion for the Mobile newspaper, along with lots of other things. But as our staff shrank, the only upside of that, before we pretty much collapsed altogether, along with our sister paper in New Orleans at the time, the upside was that for those of us who were still there, we were asked to do ever more things, and I was asked to cover the religion beat. And actually, my first response is like, well, I will, but, you know, I'm a Jew, and this is, you know, predominantly Christian place. There are 9,000 Jews in Alabama and 4 million Southern Baptists. A million Southern Baptists, one out of every four, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not that I was averse to that, but I wanted to make it clear that I was coming from it, even though I was born and bred there, as were my parents,
right.
from a slightly different angle. And it turned out to be a richly educational experience for me, in which I heard many faith stories and people of all different backgrounds, and also realized how often people misunderstand the folks in the church across the street. We're not talking just Jew and Christian. It can be one group of Protestants and another group of Protestants. And as a result, I realized that I wanted to get at the faith journeys of these characters. Not all of them are as deeply enmeshed in it as others, because it is something that is often quite just below the surface mm-hmm. of people we know, and especially in this part of the country. And the weather image of landfall with the hurricanes and the study of weather on the part of Frank, the Air Force officer, becomes, in a way, to have it sort of biblical references because of all of the way in which weather plays into, and particularly floods and hurricanes, into these stories in the Bible. And again, that's not that I am pushing that particular part of the story, but for at least one character, and maybe more than one, this is the way that they see the world. You know, Susan, I write in close third person for all you writing students out there, on the shoulder of the character and then going to being on the shoulder of another mm-hmm. character. So rather than there being any one point of view which dominates this novel, I was interested in looking at the different points of view. So whereas religion to one character may be something that they feel is not that consequential in their lives, to another it's something that's very shaping. And with the Vietnamese family, the Buddhism was very important.
Oh, yes. That was fascinating. And, you know, for Angela, one of the main characters, this great struggle.
A great struggle, yes. Because the pivotal relationship, well, the two pivotal relationships, Angela and her grandmother, she calls mm-hmm. Nana, and then Angela and Frank, the young couple who meet, whose relationship will evolve to those who read the book and understand mm-hmm. it. And she is like so many contemporary young people in that she may come from a faith upbringing, but it's not something that she feels defines her. And yet as storms come onto her shore and her own sense of belief in even the goodness of people might be tested, then as with all of us, sometimes these spiritual considerations come into play.
Well, and you long for it. You long for that surety. And you recently wrote a fabulous article for the New York Times about remembering to pray.
Yes. I wrote a personal essay for the New York Times that became one of the most emailed that week. And I say that not to boast, although I was very happy about it, but because it sort of took me aback that this many people around the country and around the world were interested in this topic. And I'm still getting letters from people. From yearners, from seekers, insomniacs, believers, infidels, you name it. It was a personal essay about having just turned 60 and standing right before the sunset on Mobile Bay and feeling not in anguish or not in pain. And certainly those are times in which we might be pushed to pray if we are right. religious people. But thinking about the fullness of life and wanting to pray, wanting to offer a prayer of gratitude, but thinking how long it had really been since I had prayed. And into that, I folded the experiences I had, very much from a Jewish perspective, of the stories told to me by evangelicals, by Catholic nuns, by people of all kinds of backgrounds, and how in a way it began to make me closer to my own upbringing. It made me wonder, well, what do I believe, not just culturally, not just sociologically, but what do I really believe spiritually? And it ends with the prayer that I wrote, which they published. And I'm mm-hmm. very pleased to say that I have gotten notes from, or it was posted with the notes on the article, there were hundreds of them, that people of different faith traditions were offering this prayer, you know, at their meeting or their luncheon and right. and so on. And it's not copyrighted, so.
Well, it seems to go hand in hand with this lovely book.
Well,
it really, really does. We've been talking with novelist Roy Hoffman, whose new book is Come Landfall. You can meet him Wednesday, April 30th at 6 at Octavia Books. Thank you so much, Roy.
Thank you so much, Susan. You're a wonderful interviewer.
John Gary teaches creative writing at the University of New Orleans and is the author of several works of poetry, including Charlemagne, A Song of Gestures, The Enemies of Leisure, Davenport's Version, and A Gallery of Ghosts, as well as a substantial body of criticism. Today, we'll be talking with him about his new collection, Have At You Now. Welcome, John Gary.
Thank you, Susan. It's always such a delight to be in your company. It raises my spirits in immeasurable
well,
way.
Well, good. It's great to have you back on The Reading Life for this new book. Now, this collection takes its title from a scene in Shakespeare's Hamlet. So set that scene for us and tell us why it inspired you.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of lines from Hamlet that have inspired me for a long time. Hamlet is one of those texts that every time you read it or see it, it has an entirely different meaning. I've taught the play more times than I can tell, but every time I look at it or talk to students about it or see it on stage or watch Olivier's film or any of the others, I always discover in it something I never knew was there before. It is a way to measure one's life by what you discover in Hamlet or other Shakespeare plays. And for a long time, this scene at the end in the fifth act where everybody gets killed and where Laertes, the one-time Hamlet friend and sort of his foil in the play, is in this dubious position where he wants, with the poisoned rapier, to defeat Hamlet in what's supposed to be just a friendly fencing match, is failing to get Hamlet in the match. And of course, the king has put his ring in the goblet with the poison on it, and Hamlet won't drink the poison, and he won't get hit by the rapier. So Laertes has to catch him off guard when Hamlet is at rest. And suddenly he turns to him and says, "Have at you now." And he injures him. He just nips him with the rapier. And that, of course, leads to Hamlet's death. It's the suddenness and abruptness of it that I think is so telling in the play. And I guess is which somehow links to my sense of experience in my life of constantly being caught off guard.
Of course.
You know, and the poems are, I hope, trying to represent that shifting and that surprise, which is both delightful and sometimes not so much.
Right. Some of these poems seem a little looser to me than things you've written in the past. And some of them seem lighter.
Well, I mean, there's always a range, I hope.
I know. It's incredible to go from, what's that first poem, this, to a friend dying of cancer in a war zone, and then to go from that to something like A Rasputin of Emphasis, which is so, it just made me laugh and laugh to read it. Would you read just the opening of that poem for us?
I will, but I'll say this. This line, A Rasputin of Emphasis, comes from Frank O'Hara, the poet, and also the second line of this poem is also a line from Frank O'Hara, where he was writing a postcard to someone. So you'll hear that in the Brancusi line. But I'll read about five stanzas from A Rasputin of Emphasis. Breezing fidipidesily by my Le Corbusier. Feeling more Brancusi than usual? She asked. I was Eisensteined. John locked in a lost Maeterlinck. So let's decide right here. Or Pétain, she Bismarcked, degalling Churchills of terror down my spine. Together, now, I welked, alarmed as a camel, as I T.E. Lawrenced, then D.H.'d side to side, not recovered yet from my inflamed longinuses, my throat still Horace, my voice as xanthippied as the sands of the Socrates coast. But with ichthynous fingers she Nietzsche'd my neck in a tender Lenin of love, our whole afternoon unhooverly spent in whistlers of near misses, her juicy cassats, the Werner von Braun in my lap, until on the verge of a total Toscanini, in utter Disraeli and Gladstone, she Carmen Miranda'd straight from my flat and sped off in her Xavier Cugat.
You'd love to read that, don't you?
If they allow me to do it.
I think Carmen Miranda'd is one of the best verbs ever.
That's great. Thanks.
So when you look back on this, because you've written so much now, I mean, where do you put this collection in your own estimation of your body of work?
Oh, that's not an easy question to answer. It takes me so long to write poems mm-hmm. or to feel like they're where I want them to be that it is a kind of a plateau to reach a certain point. I've become increasingly interested in, without trying, writing poems that are linked, sequences. Uh-huh. And sequences often start with a single poem, and then you do a second one, and then you start to realize maybe this will be a sequence of four or 40. You don't know.
Yeah.
And so this book, in that sense, the way that the title is a kind of a stabbing out by Laertes, is perhaps provoking a number of different potential sequences that are not so much in the book itself, but could be kind of launching points. So in that way, I guess it's a kind of a turning point.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I have some time left to explore things. You get to a certain age, all writers do, I think, where you didn't get as far as you thought you would by the time you reach that age.
Yeah.
And you have a different sense of an ending. And this book sort of stands on that apex. If I'm lucky and have motivation, I hope to be able to continue to work for some time. So I don't like to think that I'm coming to the close.
No.
But it's different from my earlier books, which felt like they were building towards something.
And some of these poems have that sense of reckoning. You know, like this is a moment where I am making a decision, like that poem Done Reading, which I wish you would read now.
Okay.
I love that poem.
Yes, that poem is this thing that you don't seem to experience by my sense of you, Susan, and that is that sometimes I just turn around and I get sick of it. I hate books. They plague me. They torture me, you know. And sometimes it's like, I wish I hadn't decided 40-some years ago that I had to have poetry in my life. Because once you make that decision, you can't shrug it off.
Nope.
It's like having a close relative that you cannot disown. And there are times when I kind of wish that I would, or I read a book and say, I wish I didn't have to read this book. And then, of course, the next day, I feel very close to it. So this poem is kind of exploring that a little bit, called Done Reading. I doubt I'll read again F. Scott Fitzgerald's This Side of Paradise. I'm 20 years older than he when he wrote it, so can't backslide now and choose among the plenty of things I haven't read by him that book. Because as much as I might learn from his mistakes, instead of searching for his flaws in my free time, I'll turn to the mysterious new moods. I'll look to leap from the just published pages of those the omnibus reviews praise as our deep contemporary sages. It's sad to think that spring I savored Fitzgerald's prose, like an old friend I've lost touch with, is gone for good. Books fling secrets no friendship knows across the body, flush with discretion. And in that heat of innocence undone, age notwithstanding, I invariably have felt complete dissatisfaction. Still, one by one, the titles high atop my shelves disown all claims to permanence, like aging queens. Prepare to be forgot, they groan, even as they betray the sense, I'll always find them there.
They do tend to reproach us from the shelves, don't they?
They do.
Oh.
This was a poem I actually wrote before Katrina, and in Katrina, my wife, Biliana, and I lost about 2,500 or 3,000 books.
Oh, John.
And so those books that seemed like they were going to be there forever were suddenly not. These were on the lower, not the high, the lower shelves in our house. But there's that sense that the books can be replaced, but somehow the books that you've had, that mm-hmm. you've marked, that you've been attached to, are difficult to lose. That was probably the most difficult thing for us from the hurricane.
I can't imagine. Yeah. I really can't. Ah, Well, thank God you're still writing new ones. That's always a good thing.
Thanks.
We've been talking with poet John Gary, whose new collection is Have At You Now. You can hear him read Thursday, April 24th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. John, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. Thanks for this opportunity.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. I'm delighted to be speaking at the Friends of the UNO Library reception for World Book Night Givers, Tuesday, April 22nd at 5:30 in room 407 at the UNO Earl K. Long Library. John Griswold discusses and signs Pirates You Don't Know and Other Adventures in the Examined Life, Tuesday, April 22nd at 6 at Octavia Books. Richard Sexton discusses and signs Creole World, Photographs of New Orleans in the Latin Caribbean Sphere, Tuesday, April 22nd at 6 at the Historic New Orleans Collections, Laura Simon Nelson Gallery, 400 Charter Street. And again, Tuesday, April 29th at 6 at Octavia Books. Watch for World Book Night Givers out on the town on World Book Night. That's Wednesday, April 23rd this year. I'll be hitting the streets handing out copies of Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City. See you out there. Zachary Lazar signs I Pity the Poor Immigrant, Wednesday, April 23rd at 6 at Antenna Gallery. Room 220 presents a happy hour salon with local authors Zachary Lazar and Daniel Castro from 6 to 9 on Thursday, April 24th at the Press Street headquarters, 3718 St. Claude Avenue. Sally Asher signs Hope in New Orleans, A History of Crescent City Street Names, Thursday, April 24th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Dr. Michael Sag signs Positive, One Doctor's Encounters with Death, Life, and the U.S. Healthcare System, Thursday, April 24th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, John Gary, reads from and signs Have At You Now, Thursday, April 24th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Science Fiction, Horror, and Fantasy Writers Group meets Thursday, April 24th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, Roy Hoffman, signs Come Landfall, Wednesday, April 30th at 6 at Octavia Books. Now the Jazz Fest book tent cubes are out, and here are the authors for the first weekend. Friday, April 25th, Denise McConduit signs her DJ books at noon. Rebecca Sive, Every Day is Election Day, at 1. Nancy Dixon, N.O. Lit, at 3. Anne Benoit, New Orleans Best Ethnic Restaurants, at 4. James Cobb, Flood of Lies, at 5. Saturday, April 26th, Dean Alger signs Original Guitar Hero and the Power of Music, the legendary Lonnie Johnson, Music and Civil Rights, at noon. Jay Massa signs Not Just Another Thursday Night, Kermit Ruffins and Vaughn's Lounge, at 1. Edward Brantley signs New Orleans Jazz, at 2. Jeremy Labadie and Argyle Wolf Knapp sign New Orleans Beer, at 3. Carolyn Cobb signs New Orleans Memories, at 4. And Richard Campanella signs Bourbon Street, at 5. Sunday, April 27th. Patrice Konenchek signs In a Wild Crocodile, New Orleans Slow Cooker Recipes, at noon. John Wirt signs Huey Piano Smith and the Rockin' Pneumonia Blues, at 1. Rebecca Snedeker signs Unfathomable City, at 2. Donald Link signs Down South, Bourbon, Pork, Gulf Shrimp, and Second Helpings of Everything. That's at 3. And Matt Sacchini signs Roll With It, Brass Bands in the Streets of New Orleans, at 4. And there will be a Jazz Fest open mic reading Sunday, April 27th at 3 p.m. at the Maple Leaf Bar. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.